Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it is my great pleasure to introduce you to the festival's 2014 season, Around Dvorak. Music at Menlo's 2014 season explores dual facets of the unfolding of Western music throughout the classical and romantic eras and into the 20th century. Catalyzed by a lineage of composers from Haydn and Mozart, through Schubert and Brahms, to Schoenberg, Webern, and Berg a generation later, Vienna emerged as the epicenter of a dynamic musical tradition that remains central to the canon today. Meanwhile, starting in the latter half of the 19th century, the folk traditions of Hungary, Romania, and the Czech lands permeated Western classical music, as composers like Bedřich Smetana, Leoš Janáček, Béla Bartók, and Zoltán Kodály awakened to the richness of their own musical heritage and sought to cultivate a distinct musical voice. At the center of this dialectic was Antonín Dvořák, the self-described simple Czech musicant who likewise possessed the romantic ferocity of his mentor, Johannes Brahms. No other composer so fluently integrated the dual traditions of Western classicism and Central European folk music, developing a distinct musical language whose influence would be felt as far as the United States. This season, Music at Menlo offers 8 colorful concert programs that revolve around Dvorak, taking listeners on a thrilling journey between Vienna, Prague, and other fascinating musical destinations along the way. Audio notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by artistic co-director Wu Han, Audio Notes author and producer Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the festival.
Concert Program 6, Transitions, presents Dvorak as the nexus of an intriguing chapter in the unfolding of Western music. His Opus 48 string sextet demonstrates the fully developed voice of a master of the Romantic era, nurtured and profoundly influenced by his mentor Johannes Brahms. For his part, Brahms represents a fork in the road of music history, leading in one direction to Dvorak's fulfillment of the Viennese tradition and in the other towards 20th century modernism. For although Brahms was chided by some in his final years as old-fashioned, he would be vindicated by such avant-garde voices as Arno Schoenberg and Anton Webern, who credited Brahms' late music as predictive of their own. On the parallel track, Dvorak's music explores his Czech roots, a pursuit shared with one of his greatest compatriots and contemporaries, Leoš Janáček.
In a time when cults of devotees coalesced around Richard Wagner's revolutionary music dramas, Johannes Brahms established himself as an important contemporary musical voice by working within classical forms. The violinist Josef Helmesberger, after reading Brahms's piano quartet in G minor, eagerly exclaimed, "This is the air of Beethoven." Contrary to Franz Liszt's claim that new wine demands new bottles, Brahms found the forms that served the imaginations of Mozart and Beethoven sufficient for the purposes of his musical expression. Following the death of Robert Schumann in 1856, Brahms emerged as chamber music's most significant voice. His solo and chamber works reflect the essence of his creativity as thoroughly as his orchestral pieces, and embody the spirit of the second half of the 19th century. But despite his adherence to the past, Brahms's music nevertheless points forward as well. Schoenberg counted Brahms among his greatest aesthetic influences, and expounded on Brahms's forward-looking compositional technique in his famous essay, Brahms the Progressive. Brahms completed his 6 piano pieces, Opus 118, as part of a concentrated wave of piano miniatures composed near the end of his life, between 1892 and 1893. Despite their brevity, the 6 pieces traverse a broad emotive landscape. Michael Steinberg has written of these pieces, quote, Here, in these late musings of a keyboard master who had discovered how to speak volumes with the sparest of gestures, we find the essence of Brahms. End quote. Brahms sent the six pieces, as well as the four intermezzi that followed as his Opus 119, as gifts to the aging Clara Schumann as he completed them. Brahms' biographer Jan Swofford has surmised, quote, he may have composed the pieces to try and keep Clara Schumann going in body and soul. Since she could only play a few minutes at a time now, and because she loved these miniatures so deeply, maybe they did keep her alive. End quote. Brahms marks the opening intermezzo, Allegro non assai, ma molto appassionato. Not fast, but very passionately. Throughout the six pieces, Brahms favors ternary, or ABA, form. At the start of the first intermezzo's B section, Brahms fluidly integrates rhythmic and harmonic tension. Cascading eighth-note runs disrupt the rhythmic motif established in the opening measures. A series of diminished seventh chords, a favorite harmony of the Romantic composers for its unresolved pathos, harmonically reinforces the passage's anxious forward motion. While the Opus 118 pieces share no thematic connections, Brahms sequenced them with clear and deliberate intentions. The first intermezzo, set in A minor, ends brightly in A major, preparing a seamless transition to the much-beloved Andante Teneramente that follows in the same key. This tender intermezzo resembles the Songs Without Words of Mendelssohn, whose piano music certainly influenced Brahms. Each piece of the Opus 118 set offers its share of magical moments. Listen, for example, to this inspired change of key from G minor to B major in the Ballade No. 3. A haunting theme, evocative of the Gregorian Dies Irae chant, opens the final intermezzo, set in the morose key of E flat minor. Brahms introduces the melody as a stark, unaccompanied line marked sotto voce. Low, rumbling arpeggiations in the left hand heighten the music's angst. A B section of Beethovenian drama disrupts the funereal proceedings. But unlike Beethoven's prototypical heroic journey, which follows elegy with transcendence, Brahms's final measures here remain somber and defeated. Best known as the devoted disciple and torchbearer of Arnold Schoenberg's 12-tone method, the Viennese composer Anton Webern, in fact, underwent numerous artistic transformations over the course of his career. His early works, including the two pieces for cello and piano, written in 1899, bear the hallmarks of late Romanticism and betray the influence of Wagner, Mahler, and Strauss. His gradual flirtation with atonal music culminated with the settings of 14 poems by Stefan George, composed between 1908 and 1909, which represented a complete departure from tonality. With the Opus 20 String Trio of 1927, Webern achieved full mastery of the 12-tone method, which he followed more strictly than even Schoenberg for the remainder of his career. The pieces that first heralded Webern's total abandonment of tonality, spanning the years 1908 to 1914, have been commonly referred to as Webern's aphoristic works. The music of this period, which includes another cello-piano duo, the Three Pieces Opus 11, is marked by its extreme brevity and an obsession with softness and silence. Entire pieces range in dynamic from pianissimo to no louder than piano. The third of the Opus 11 pieces rises only to a pianissimo. In the works of his aphoristic period, Webern places unprecedented import on sonic gesture. Movements as short as 20 seconds magnify such instrumental effects as pizzicato, harmonics, and collegno, bowing with the wood rather than the hair of the bow, into musical events in themselves. Schoenberg noted of Webern's works during this period, quote, "One has to realize what restraint it requires to express oneself with such brevity. You can stretch every glance into a poem, every sigh into a novel. But to express a novel in a single gesture, a joy in a breath, such concentration can only be present in the absence of self-pity." End quote.
I'm very excited to be playing this, the two sets of pieces by Webern side by side.
Cellist Dmitri Etapin.
Usually, in my experience, they're performed either the early pieces or the later pieces. And it's an interesting juxtaposition of compositional languages, because the two early pieces were written when Webern was just 15 years old in 1899, and somehow they reflect what a young composer would do, I guess, when writing for a combination of a cello and a piano. It explores the cello's lush tone, very romantic, very singing qualities of the cello, while the piano provides this lush and beautiful harmonies. The first piece strikes me by its melodiousness, its reflective and longing qualities. The second has this kind of a hopeful character, and it's very ecstatic in its culmination.
Thank you.
just after that, we will play the three short pieces, Opus 11. Webern was very fond of this work. They were written in 1914, and somehow I see them as a kind of distillation of his earlier work. He's discovering a new language. The lush melodies get reduced to 2-3 note motifs, and it's an extremely concise and meticulous compositional language. These pieces go extremely quickly by. By the time you know what to listen for, they're already gone. And I find that very fascinating because, for me, it's more about the impression they leave in the listener's ear rather than living in them, if you know what I mean. They're much more about the memory of them rather than living through the time of music as you follow it. Because by the time you start following it, it's already ephemeral and gone. First one is extremely gestural and has these sporadic incisions by the two different instruments. Second one is more marching, more angular, more robust, I would say.
The second of the Opus 11 pieces is also breathtakingly short. Here's the second piece in its entirety.
And the third one is really mysterious and enigmatic. It creates these sound worlds with the harmonics, the low cello, long note. For me, the third piece is very much a question rather than an answer to the earlier two.
In the years since his death in 1928, the Czech composer Leoš Janáček has increasingly become regarded as one of the most original composers of the 20th century. His 9 operas represent his crowning achievement, and Janáček likewise considered these to be his most important work. But he did write a fair amount of chamber and orchestral music as well, and the dramatic instinct and rhetorical expressivity that infuse his operatic output are key elements of his style and likewise inform his instrumental works. Janáček was especially preoccupied with the Czech language, and in his chamber and orchestral music, he attempted to capture the cadence and inflection of Czech in his melodic writing. The result is a kind of expressive immediacy entirely unique to Janáček. Janáček composed his concertino for piano and ensemble in 1925 for the pianist Jan Hermann. He was inspired to write the work after hearing Hermann play in a performance of his song cycle, The Diary of One Who Disappeared. The concertino was written a year after his wind sextet Mladý, Janáček's nostalgic reminiscence of his youth. The concertino shares something of the sextet's sprightly energy. Janáček acknowledged, quote, "The whole thing comes from the youthful mood of Mladý," end quote. Like many of Janáček's mature works, the concertino had a programmatic genesis. In this case, in keeping with the childish joy of Mladý, the composer imagined his young self in nature scenes amidst talking animals. But this extra musical program is just a point of departure for the small masterpiece of a concertino, whose enchanting music more than stands up on its own. The concertino is scored for piano with a colorful ensemble of 2 violins, viola, clarinet, horn, and bassoon. But Janáček uses the ensemble sparingly. The first movement is scored for just piano and horn. Janáček's programmatic image here was of a hedgehog trying to get back into its lair, but the boy Janáček and his pals have blocked the entrance. The spiky ascending theme, rounded off with a downward turn, represents the hedgehog's frustration. Fantasy appealed to Janáček throughout his life, and the accompanying sense of wonder permeates his musical language. In this first movement, mysterious harmonies quietly evoke a wooded fairy tale setting. That downward turn at the end of the central motif spirals into a new musical idea, as the dialogue between piano and horn grows more animated. But the excitement quickly subsides, and the spiky opening theme returns to close the movement. The up-tempo second movement is scored for piano and clarinet. The quick chords and abrupt silences that start things off represent a swirl dashing sporadically from branch to branch. The clarinet follows with a rascally melody above a light staccato piano accompaniment. The young Janáček captures the squirrel in a cage. Its futile attempts to escape are illustrated by long trills above static harmonies. The full ensemble finally appears in the movement's final measures. And the music segues into the third movement, portraying a mass of squawking birds. Janáček's deployment of the instruments here is simultaneously ravishing and eerie. The music proceeds without pause to the allegro finale. Thank you. The piano presents a puckish tune, accompanied by syncopated pizzicati in the violins. The music escalates into a boisterous racket by the full ensemble. The piano calls for everyone's attention with a frenzied cadenza, followed by a triumphant proclamation, issued to the exultant acclaim of the strings. After a brief meditative utterance in the piano, the full ensemble joins back in, and the concertino comes to an exhilarated close.
The program concludes with one of the most beloved works in the Romantic repertoire for strings, Antonín Dvořák's String Sextet in A Major, Opus 48.
Dvořák composed his Opus 48 sextet over a two-week period in 1878, and in the wake of an important dual success. His three Slavonic rhapsodies and the first set of his Slavonic dances for orchestra had premiered in May of that year, fueling his rise to international stardom. Just as those works helped to establish Dvořák not only as an important new compositional voice, but as representative of a distinctly Czech style, so did the String Sextet reinforce that reputation in the realm of chamber music. The work received its premiere in July 1879 at a private performance in the home of the great violinist Josef Joachim in Berlin, marking Dvořák's first premiere outside of Czechoslovakia. Over the next year, Joachim would perform the sextet in Vienna and twice in London, effectively solidifying Dvořák's international stature for good. The sextet is brimming with bohemian charm, even as it recalls Schubert, Dvořák's favorite composer in his early years, in its abundance of inspired melodies. Moreover, Dvořák draws a rapturous sonic warmth from the ensemble of two violins, two violas, and two cellos. One benefit of this rich scoring is the ability of the second cello to serve as the bass voice, allowing the first to pursue a lyrical melodic role. The main theme of the first movement, introduced as a rhapsodic duet between first violin and first cello, demonstrates all of these qualities. The tempo quickens and a new musical idea appears, marked by upward leaps and excitable dotted rhythms. In the spirit of Schubert, Dvořák extends these themes to euphoric effect just within the movement's exposition. Soon, the first theme reappears, set in the violin's lustrous soprano register. Mm-hmm. The second theme returns, now less boisterous, taking on instead a somewhat introspective air. At the end of the exposition, the first theme surfaces once again, now marked molto tranquillo. Then we come to the movement's central development section, driven by the short-breath rhythmic gait of the second theme. Dvorak gives the sunny first theme a newly tempestuous demeanor. The storm continues to build, and the full ensemble comes hurtling to the end of the development section, only to pull up at the last moment and ease gently into the recapitulation. The sextet's middle two movements draw from traditional folk forms. The second movement is a dumka, a sung Slavic folk ballad. Phlegmatic pizzicati in the cellos and plaintive sighs in the violas accompany a ruminative melody in the violins. Midway through the movement, Dvorak introduces a poignant gypsy-like music. This soon gives way to a tender andante lullaby in the rarefied key of F sharp major. The understated tones of the dumka are obliterated by the rambunctious third movement. This movement is a furiant, a traditional Czech folk dance. The word furiant literally means a proud, swaggering, conceited man, an apt description of the music's impetuous energy. The final movement is a set of five variations on a melancholy theme presented by the first viola, accompanied by the second viola and cellos. The absence of the brighter toned violins accentuates the theme's moodiness. ¶¶ The violins join in for the first variation, the deployment of the full ensemble playing long legato phrases, and the 2-against-3 rhythmic scheme lend the music a rich sonority. The second variation is redolent of a scherzo in Mendelssohn's signature Midsummer Night's Dream style. The first cello issues the desolate melody in the third variation. The rest of the ensemble holds a spacious pianissimo chord, evoking a lonely wanderer in a barren landscape. That sense of desolation extends into the fourth variation, but now given anxious voice by the violins and first viola above a threatening undercurrent of triplets in the second cello. From the uneasiness of this fraught music emerges the fifth variation, which resets the theme with the immediacy of a folk song. Flowing 16th notes, punctuated by hocketing pizzicati, make for a texturally rich accompaniment. Dvorak follows the fifth variation with an energetic stretta, or a kind of extended coda. Finally, as if he were simply biding his time throughout the five lugubrious variations, Dvorak allows wild elation to burst forth like a wound-up jack-in-the-box, and the sextet gallops excitedly to its blistering conclusion. Audio Notes are authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts on this disc appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Dvorak Sonatina for Violin and Piano is performed by violinist Kai Gloystein and pianist Catherine Ordronov, and appears courtesy of AV Records. Louis Moreau Gottschalk's The Union, performed by Philip Martin, and Charles Ives's Songs, performed by baritone Gerald Finley and pianist Julius Drake, appear courtesy of Hyperion Records. George Crumb's American Songbook II, A Journey Beyond Time, performed by Barbara Ann Martin and Orchestra 2001, conducted by James Freeman, appears courtesy of Bridge Records. Brahms's 6 pieces for piano, Opus 118, are performed by Wu Han and appear on Artist-Led Records. Anton Webern's 2 early pieces and 3 pieces, Opus 11, for cello and piano, performed by cellist Clemens Hagen and pianist Oleg Meisenberg, and Leos Janáček's Concertino, performed by Rudolf Verkusny and the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, appear courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Janáček's Melody, performed by flautist Carol Winsens, oboist Alan Vogel, clarinetist Anthony McGill, bass clarinetist Carrie Bell, bassoonist Frank Morelli, and hornist Richard Todd, appears courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Dvorak's String Sextet in A Major, Opus 48, is performed by violinists Joseph Silverstein and Annika Vafian, violists Mark Holloway and Paul Neubauer, and cellists Andreas Brantelid and Fred Sherry, and appears courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.